The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
It's Wednesday. It's supposed to be, I did hear this, I was told, it's supposed to be 105 or hotter here for the next 10 days. Now, this is Oregon, not Death Valley. And it's supposed to be 117 Saturday. It's no joke. It never used to be like this. I've been up here for 25 years, and never was it like this. And it is now. So the weather meisters have been playing their game, and they either lost control of it all, or they're sadomasochists, and they're harming everybody and themselves, and they don't seem to care. And we've got that hurricane, record-breaking hurricane for this time of the season. But we will see. We will see what happens. Okay, tonight, first guest, Susan Bradford, one of America's really extraordinarily talented, dedicated researchers. Geopolitically speaking, there's no one that does better research than Susan. She has a new book out called The Saudi Swindle. You can find it under her name. Her Substack page is also under her name, or will be momentarily. And I want to say hello, Susan. Welcome back.
Hello, Jeff. Thank you so much for having me. And you mentioned the high weather. I'm originally from California, and I was shocked to see that in Palm Springs it was 120 degrees to get today.
Wow!
Really quite shocked.
Okay.
It's never been
too
that
hot.
High.
No. Too hot. I don't like heat. Thank God it's dry heat here. I would have to flee. I couldn't take it. I was once in New Orleans, and it was 98 humidity. Whatever. It was awful. I don't know. I couldn't breathe very well. But this is 120 degrees. That's crazy. Where in California were you from? What was your original area generally?
It was in the South Bay.
Uh-huh. Gotcha. All right. Yeah. Crazy. Well, we all know that Redding up at the top of the Sacramento Valley is always a cauldron of heat. Those poor people are probably doing Las Vegas right now. I mean, Palm Springs, and it's hot there. Dane Wigington lives down there. Go ahead.
It is. I just remember consistently nice warm weather, 78, 80 degrees all year round. Give or take.
That's it. That's right. That's right. And it was similar to that here. We'd get up in the low 90s once in a while in the summer. But this is ludicrous, and it's clearly not natural. There has been a change. There are changes all over the place. I worked in Las Vegas for 3 years, and I had to leave. It was too hot for me. I don't know what it's like there now. But I remember getting off work at midnight after doing the late news. I was in television news then. And I walked out, and there was a big temperature gauge up on top of the Sahara Hotel then, and at midnight, and it said 112. And I just said, this is ludicrous. And I literally gave my notice, I think, the next day. And 2 weeks later, I went back to Santa Barbara. I couldn't take it. It's too much for me. Don't like it. No, thank you.
Well, you found your place here. National treasure.
Well, thank you. It's very sweet. You have been working and watching. And I just generally... How appalled are you at the level of control and the ugliness of the control that is being exerted upon all of us who live in this country? Give us a little overview. How appalled are you?
I'm horrified. I think there's an evil and malevolent intent against the American people, and this kind of insidious agenda has been working against us. I think really, it really goes back to, it's the founding of the country, but the Civil War, when they established the corporation of the United States doing business as the representative government, which it right. no longer is.
Right.
And they've been essentially trying to, to take our money, our assets, demoralize us. Everything imaginable that they could do to, to strip us of our humanity, they've done. It's horrible.
Well said. I also want to point out that I don't go out much, but I had to go out today to a store to pick something up, not food, something else. And the quality of people out there, and I'm not being an elitist by any possible stretch of the imagination, but I'm seeing people who are acting semi-competent in terms of what they seemingly used to be like. They say thank you sometimes and pardon me, but they're just, they present as being really not very smart. And I'm not surprised, because their diet is the reality that they're being exposed to 25 hours a day on their flat screen, whether it's in their hand or on their wall, it doesn't matter, or their computer on the desk. That's the reality that most of them, whether they want to agree with it or not, that's the reality that most of them embrace. That's the reality, because they see it all the time.
That's correct. I think the as you said, like the social media is rewiring their brains, so they're becoming less critical, less critical, less competent, and I think a lot of people are so demoralized, and I think their incomes are so depressed as well, that I think many of them don't care.
I think that's part of what I'm seeing for sure. A lack of, they're just going through the motions. They're phoning it in, as they say. They really don't care. I can't blame them. These are unprecedented times, and all the more horrible, horrified is a good word, because they're contrived. They didn't have to be this way, but that's what the elite wanted, and so they're tearing it down. And I was told about this 8 years ago, and it's happening. It's not fun.
Well, let's see if we can do something to reverse course.
Good. All right. Go to it. The Saudi swindle. By the way, just as a general preface, I would say that of all Middle Eastern countries, Americans might know in the aggregate less about the Saudis than any other country in some ways. The Saudis are very unscrupulous. They're in my view, they're very sneaky. Tell me what you found. What's your take?
Well, I think that may be true at the higher levels. I think that originally, the City of London had staked its claim on Saudi oil, and then World War II. And I know there are many different factors that contributed to World War II, but one of them was that the Rockefellers had built up Hitler to threaten England, and then so that England would beg Rockefeller to bring the United States into war. And the condition that they put upon that inclusion was that the British had to relinquish Saudi oil. And so the Rockefellers were attempting to establish a global monopoly on oil. They were granted that concession. And then after World War II, the globalists, including Rockefeller, Rothschild, City of London, established a new global infrastructure whereby they would develop the world with U.S. assets, you know, with the fiat currency. And they made the Saudi Arabia the development partner. So they, essentially they were trying to, they had unlimited amounts of oil that would be used as a basis in which to develop the world. And that really put us on a slippery, you know, slope downward.
That was the petrodollar. That's where that came from.
That happened a few decades later during the Nixon administration, and that's when they formalized the technical relationship between the Saudis and the World Bank. And so you had the dollar decoupled from gold, the launch of the petrodollar, and then you had us committing ourselves to the energy security of Israel, and then an administration earlier, a few administrations earlier with JFK, JFK signed an executive order to create the U.S. AID, which then committed us to developing over 100 countries worldwide. And we were not... like after investing in these countries, we weren't getting a return on that investment. Essentially, we were creating monopolies for the corporations, you know, with us, you know, shouldering that debt.
Got it. Aramco. Give us a little quick overview on Aramco. That was an interesting development. It's changed now, but Aramco is a key player for decades, many decades.
It is. In the mid-1970s, Aramco was nationalized, and this was the point at which the Rockefellers were being kind of pushed out of Saudi Arabia, out of the kingdom, and they intentionally overproduced the wells, the Saudi oil fields, in order to extract as much oil as they possibly could. And what happened is that they damaged the fields on the way out. And this was recognized by, you know, Seymour Hersh and Jack Anderson, the Aramco executives had also, you know, acknowledged that the fields were damaged in closed Senate hearings. And what happened from that point onwards is that the petrodollar was then put on borrowed time because they no longer had an unlimited amount of oil with which to develop the world. And so you have, like, the World Bank is setting the price of oil on the world stage. So with an unlimited supply of oil, the elites could kind of set up unlimited supply chains throughout the world, establishing a global monopoly, and, you know, they're, you know, in charge of the oil, the price of oil. They can ship their products to different countries, while USAID is supplying the money, you know, and we have, you know, the World Bank and IMF and so forth are providing the funding to help these elites establish monopolies throughout the world. And so once the petrodollar was on the downturn, they had to find an alternative to how they were going to keep their global agenda on track.
Interesting. Okay. Right now, who is running the Saudi oil empire? Is it really Sheikh MBS, the crown prince, or his dad? Or are we looking at ultimately the Rothschilds pushing them around?
I'm not sure if the Rockefellers are a key player anymore. I think the Rothschilds overtook them. Remember that, you know, during the Trump administration, that MBS had, you know, his rivals arrested, that the, you know, the royals arrested.
Yeah.
That was a classic, you know, Rothschild move, like a communist move, where they, you know, you target the wealthy, you take their assets, then you point yourself at the head. MBS controls the sovereign wealth fund, and I think the sovereign, if I'm not mistaken, the sovereign wealth fund has acquired you know, the oil company as well. And they were tasked with, like the World Bank and Saudi Arabia were tasked with alleviating poverty. But what they've done instead is they've used the assets. I think there's about, you know, $2 trillion that they've accumulated, and they're building luxury apartments and housing, and they're pushing the people off the land. You know, but I think MBS is a puppet for the Rothschilds.
All right. Okay. That's good enough. Have you, by the way, you've seen that, what the hell do they call it? I want to say the strip, but it's not that. It's that,
is it Neom?
The line. The line? What is it? It's that 100 mile long. I don't know how long it is. It's long. It's about half a mile wide, 100 miles long. It's a residential. It's a whole world, a city, a town, every couple miles and greenery in between. It's in a single line.
They're trying to create like an AI utopia.
It's kind of like that. Let me find it here. It's fascinating when you look. Nobody seems to be paying it much attention. Saudi's building. Let me see this. I'm going to call it the line. I think it's the line. Yes, the line. The line will eventually accommodate 9 million people. And it's being built right now. It's underway. And the line, let's see, how long will it take to be? They expect it to be finished by 2030. You need to look this up. People don't know about it. I mean, even unless you're looking for it, you could miss it. It's that crazy. It's this right in the middle of Hell's Kitchen, the desert, and yet it's a straight line all the way, built with glass and concrete, and then inside is a whole environment for 9 million people.
It's like a self-contained smart city, and it's interesting that Saudi Arabia...
110 miles long. Sorry, 110 miles long. I got it. Go ahead.
And it's very interesting that Saudi Arabia, that the major global oil producer, is leading the world on AI. I mean, they're leading the agenda. And they want to have zero carbon, I think, by 2030. It's been pushed back to 2050. I think now it's back to 2060.
Susan, is that a realistic goal? Are they just playing games to get rid of CO2, so to speak? When you say carbon, go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yes, I'm sorry. I think it's a deception because they don't. I don't know that they care about a green energy. Like having zero carbon. I think what they're trying to do is, since they no longer have the unlimited supply of cheap oil that was pegged to the World Bank to develop the world with U.S. assets. That they're having to figure out how are they going to keep global development on track, and that's where BRICS comes into the picture. And so they want to have enough oil to kind of do what they have to do, so they can fly their jets, their yachts, and maintain some basic transportation needs. But I think that they want to scale down society. In fact, in 2005, a gentleman by the name of Matthew Stimmons wrote a book called Twilight in the Desert. And he specifically laid out an agenda that was needed to respond to the post-oil era, and that included not traveling far from your home, having food locally produced, which has been translated into bugs and lab meat. It was essentially the agenda that they pushed during the pandemic for these the lockdowns was precisely the response that the Bush administration was rolling out in response to the overproduction of Saudi oil. So they're using that as an excuse. And they're using, green energy and so forth, global warming as an excuse.
Now, you've mentioned two things that kind of stuck in my mind. One was oil field damage. And secondly, somewhere in there, I think I caught you referring to not as much oil as there used to be, something like that. So let me just back up. Was the damage to the oil fields permanent? And is the Saudi oil future looking less rosy than it once did? In other words, are they beginning to tap into their reserves so much that there's going to be a paucity of oil?
You know, it looks like, you know, I know that they have an international kind of money laundering ring with, among the elite.
Yeah.
It also appears that they have an oil laundering system. So the United States, you know, will send its oil overseas to Saudi Arabia and to other countries and to China, even if China's a strategic adversary. And they kind of move oil around. So there's a perception that has been created that Saudi oil is not in trouble. Is not limited, but there is actually a paucity of oil. I mean, there is.
Uh-huh.
They were permanently damaged, and what happens is that I think some kind of, like, when they're overproduced, oil, water enters into the oil, and it can no longer be used. The quality is no longer there, so it has
it's
been
not
permanently
sweet,
damaged.
It's not sweet light crude. It's getting into the heavier stuff that requires more refining. Okay,
correct.
All right. Well, this is all very interesting. On the cover of Susan's book is a portrait of MBS himself, the Saudi swindle. If you met that guy at a function of some kind, what would you ask him? What questions might come to mind as a stellar researcher? What would you like him to tell you? Not that he'd tell you the truth about anything, let's be real, but what would you ask him? Any ideas?
I think I would want him to come clean, because I think I'm I want to restore integrity to governments and to, you know, the global system. I would want him to come clean with regards to 9/11 and this global pandemic lockdown. Because I think I have, you know, I have a fairly good idea of what happened and why they did what they did. I would want, you know, for example, with 9/11, you can see very clearly where the plans were put in place, you know, with the neoconservatives to create a pretext that was then used to enable the United States to go and search for oil, you know, to preemptively attack foreign countries in order to seize their oil, particularly for Israel. I know that with the pandemic lockdown, that MBS had prepared to essentially invest the Saudi sovereign fund into all of the corporations. So he knew and had anticipated that the lockdown would depress business, and then he was prepared to buy them all up in a standard Rothschild move. So I think I would want him to come clean with this, and I would want to challenge him on what do you think you're doing? This is, you know, really not appropriate. And I think that, you know, if the public were to understand what these people have done, I think that they would demand that our leaders pause the digital currency and pause the AI agenda, because these elites have created the problem, know, that they are then trying to resolve with a solution that will, of course, imprison humanity.
It will. It will. All right. The AI agenda. Stand by. We'll come back in just a couple minutes with Susan.
Okay.
And continue. Again, her book is The Saudi Swindle, How the Deception Surrounding Saudi Oil Gave Rise to the Green New Steel, The Looting of Nations, and a Global Lockdown. Be right back with Susan Bradford. Okay, welcome back. Talking with Susan Bradford about the Saudi juggernaut. Where are they going? Where is the world going? And I think all of you out there probably compromise, honestly, the most knowledgeable audience one could hope for in terms of understanding, and I'm just barely scratching the surface, of the overwhelming impact of AI on this planet. And to me, it now seems rather clear why they decided to genocide 80% of the world's people. They don't need them anymore. And also remember the clever, wizardly brilliant brainwashing of watching and hearing and accepting. And that's what TV really did. Radio was one thing. It was theater of the mind. You at least thought and ascribed pictures and images to what you were hearing. TV took that away. It didn't have to. And now television is overwhelming. And it is reality for most people. That what they see repeatedly, over and over again, rote, R-O-T-E, repetition, is how it's done. That becomes the bedrock, the baseline reality for many, many people, the majority of people. And now with the astonishing improvement in literally text to video, think about it, TTV, text to video, put in a prompt and get a full sound, audio and video motion picture, if you want, back. And the astounding clarity of the imagery is now at least as good or better than anything you could construct going out and trying to capture it on any kind of medium. They're creating it out of thin air. It's a godlike power that has been given to people now for $20 a month. They can create almost anything they want. It's staggering. And we still haven't been able to properly assay the length and breadth of the impact of AI, because AI is constantly on the move. Think about it. It's teaching itself 24 hours a day. It's nonstop. It's getting better and better at whatever it's told to do. And I have a hunch it's teaching itself anyway. I mean, how are programmers with a 120 IQ going to compete with an intelligence, and I do think sentience is applicable here, of 1,500 or higher, 2,000. We don't know. They won't tell us, but it's way beyond ChatGPT-4. I can guarantee you that. They're up there. So GPT-5 is ready to go, as I've said. I don't think they're going to release it yet because the people just, they can't handle it. You can't handle it with a 105 IQ. It's too much. They won't know what to do. I mean, they're already in the control mechanism as it is. They're not going to break loose. AI is absolutely overwhelming. I don't think I could spend an hour here and properly assay it in terms of what it's already doing and where it's going. That's just my take. I'm not speaking for Susan. So, the Saudis and AI, or AI in general, however you want to approach it. What are your thoughts?
I think you may have overestimated the potential of AI. You could be right. I know they are trying to create a supercomputer.
I hope I've overestimated it. I would be very happy. I do.
I hope you have. I think, you know, AI really amounts to algorithms. I don't know how sentient it is, though I think the elites would like us to believe it's sentient. It certainly can do a great job at impersonating a human. But with a lot of the pictures and images and sounds that it is able to create instantaneously, it has harvested all of the pictures that have been, you know, given to Facebook and to these tech companies, all of data that we've written, and it's basically absorbing all of that data and spitting it back to us, and, you know, and you know, portraying it as somehow being original. So I'm not sure how pioneering it is, but I think with the cryptocurrencies, my sense of this was that the elites were trying to replace the petrodollar, because if you recall, the original cryptocurrencies were based on mining computers. So they were pulling some type of energy out of those computers, and I think that was an attempt to replace the petrodollar. And it could be, and I maybe you could speak to this, but with the vaccines, weren't they trying to have individuals, humans, transmit energy, like with whatever they're trying to put into us, with the nanobots and...
Energy in the sense of biological nanobots or nanotechnology, engineered. This is all coming out of labs. They're bioweapons. And yes, shedding, we call it, if that's what you're alluding to. And yes, It's absolutely real. It is energy, energetic transmission, if you want to look at it that way, because it can kill. It has killed people. It is killing people right now. Just being around those who have been injected and who are dumping spike protein and apparently mRNA as well, which is the instruction packet, we'll keep it simple. That's a hell of an energetic transmission, all right. Yeah, you're onto it. The controllers, haven't held back. They've turned this loose on humankind, and as far as we can tell, this genetic change in the human physiology is not reversible, and it only is getting worse. That's what we have to say.
It's absolutely horrible. The reason I mentioned energy is I think in their greed and in their malice that they have tried to replace the petrodollar by having a limited number of people, the billions of people who populate this earth, transmit energy so they would have an unlimited amount of energy, which they could then link to a digital dollar to then continue to fund themselves and to develop the world and to establish, you know, global monopolies. I think that's where they're trying to take this.
Interesting. Now, you said something also that was very interesting, that crypto... Nothing happens spontaneously anymore, not something of the magnitude of crypto. But crypto was designed to replace something, and your suggestion is that it's the petrodollar. And that makes sense. Crypto is not gone. They're trying to tax it now. I guess the Treasury came up with a new way to tax it or to try and track people who are trading in cryptos and trading them in and selling them off and investing. It's being monitored now because it's big, and it's not going to go away. We know that. So I don't know who thought it up. I think that the folklore of the origination of it was kind of a nice smokescreen that this one guy thought it up. I personally don't think that's logical, but maybe so. I don't know. But it's really out of control in a very controlled way. This whole thing, they want us to think there's spontaneity out there. There's not. There's nothing of any consequence is let loose. It just isn't. That's not how they play the game, right?
That's true. I think that the cryptocurrencies came from China or Japan, and they were brought on board when Obama was attempting to launch his Trans-Pacific Partnership, when he was trying to realign, you know, the center of gravity, I guess the center of international commerce over into Asia. And I think that's when the Asians developed the cryptocurrency, and then they brought it over here. I think it's interesting that the cryptocurrency was developed abroad and then imported over. You know, perhaps they did not want Americans to know, you know, what was behind, you know, this new agenda.
Right, right. I get it. Well, we'll see. We will see.
We'll see.
Back to the AI. Tell me more of your thoughts about it. How does it strike you? Where do you think it's going to go? I just sent you a link to a video that I have up in headlines. It's kind of the next step forward of perfecting AI, total creativity of audio and video. It's 4 minutes long. It's quite stunning. And if people are addicted to their screens, which they are, this new level of hyper-reality is going to invade their subconscious, there won't be any resistance. It's like ice cream. It's too, you can't say no. It's fun. But this is really fun. Anyway, you take a look later.
I definitely will. Yeah, thank you for sending that. I think, you know, AI and you know, this new, you know, the information harvesting is the new gold, is the new oil. There's so much money to be made in monetizing information. And I think in response to the lack of cheap oil has led them to try to to keep us kind of holed up in one place. So in lieu of travel, you know, you could travel the world through, you know, virtual reality. Instead of shopping, you can have, Amazon or Google deliver, you know, your products through drone. Instead of, you know, traveling, you know, long commutes to work, you can, communicate via Zoom and have your doctor, you know, an AI doctor diagnose you and so forth. So I think they are trying to kind of limit human activity and, you know, basically scale back our livelihoods and our lives in order to reduce our consumption of oil. And of course, that there's the added benefit to them is in that they can track and trace our every move and then, you know, of course, apply a control system over us.
Do you think they... let me rephrase that. We're going back to your book here. Look under Susan's name. It's The Saudi Swindle. You'll see it. Check it out. It's a very unusual look at reality, which I really prize very highly. How can we assess the relationship? This is all behind the scenes, basically, between the Saudis and the Israelis, the Zionists. How do we interface those two?
Okay, that's interesting. Would you like to look at revisit 9/11?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So 9/11, you know, of course, the neoconservatives drove us into war in Iraq. In order to seize the oil for Israel, the false intelligence reports that led us into Iraq, that was driven by Ahmed Chalabi, who was promoted by an organization called BMSK, which was acquired by Burstyn-Marsteller. Burstyn-Marsteller now is the U.S. agent for SABIC, and SABIC is the Saudi company that is attempting to establish a global monopoly on agriculture. There are various links between the two of them where you can see that one is benefiting the other and they are working hand in hand. Jared Kushner has the $2 billion that he received for his hedge fund. He has expanded, he's wanted, you know, the Saudis to invest in Israeli businesses, you know, for example. So I think that the two of them are working hand in hand. I mean, there are many, you know, examples where you can see that the Zionists and the Saudis are, you know, they are aligned in their wider global objectives.
Yeah. One size fits all. It's called greed. I didn't know the Saudis were refocused on global agriculture. This is new to me. That's very interesting because we're headed towards some kind of what appears to be an engineered famine. And I had a map the other day of all the American food processing plants and facilities that have been suddenly stricken by arson fires, if not burned to the ground. Lots of them. Dozens, hundreds maybe, I don't know. But something's going on here. And if this is a global effort by the Saudis, as much as they can, to grab the food, the baseline agricultural food production paradigm, that's new to me. I didn't know this. Tell me more.
Yes, you'll see that our agriculture is being pushed. It's being taken overseas, and we're losing. Our farmers are losing their land, and you'll find that our governors, our politicians, are working hand in hand with the Saudis on helping them acquire a global monopoly on agriculture and on fertilizers. I think you'll find that the Saudi connection in Idaho and in a few other states, and I've kind of documented some of those connections on my Substack.
Wow. Well, this is interesting. Those nice little congressmen and congresswomen are helping the Saudis take over food. Very interesting.
They are. And the Saudis are spending billions of dollars in public relations and in lobbying Capitol Hill.
Well, all right. I'm learning. This is very interesting. The world is just bears little resemblance to the ball game on the big TV and the 4th of July barbecue. And these people just don't really have a clue and don't have a chance. Yes, a lot of them are waking up. They're picking up pieces here and there, and that's neat. That's nice to see. But what are they going to do about it? That's the whole question, really. And you can notice things, but what can you do about it? And that's very frustrating for a lot of people because they can't do much.
I think that the survivors of 9/11 have tried to file suit against the Saudis. And I was kind of saddened to see that our federal government paid out. I know that the argument given was that they don't want to open sovereigns to liability because, God forbid, you know, you would sue Barack Obama or Biden for their crimes against humanity. But I think it's important that these lawsuits do go through, if only from a perspective of discovery, because I think through that discovery you will find the financial networks, the complicity, the crimes against humanity that would empower the people to take their power back. And I think we have been colonized by the City of London, and these elites have abused their position, and there have been a number of precedents that have been established at the International Court of Justice, whereby colonized nations have pushed back against their colonizers and have ensured that they did not owe the debt that was imposed upon them. And I think that's one of the key issues, is that these elites are running up, billions, if not trillions of dollars in debt, essentially awarding themselves our assets, and then they're forcing us to pay their way. And I think that there are legal remedies that we can pursue.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I know we can certainly file. The question is, will the courts come through with at least a modicum of, I don't know, reasonable decisions? Some of these decisions I'm seeing are really nuts. So I don't know. They did target our judicial system, and they have been quite successful in having a major impact in that sense. You know what's really fun? Another thing you said, things always stick in my memory. You mentioned Jack Anderson. Most people listening don't know who Jack Anderson was. And there was some really good, these people were great researchers. He was a columnist, Jack Anderson. And who was his colleague that passed on and Jack continued? Jack Anderson and somebody, there was another guy. Anyway, Jack Anderson was a columnist, geopolitical columnist of note for several decades, the 60s, 70s, 80s. And nobody even knows who he is or was anymore. But that was kind of fun to hear.
He was one of the greats.
Stuart Alsop and Jack Anderson. Yeah. I think I'm right.
Yeah, they were both greats. I think in terms of what we can do, I think that the first step is to educate we the people, and I think what I've tried to do is document the entire international money laundering scheme to show the connections. And there really are a handful of individuals and companies who are driving this agenda. And they work behind many front groups and through by way of proxy, but there are only a few of them. They follow a very distinct pattern, and they are behind the recurring crimes against humanity, from the pandemic to 9/11 to some of these Green New Deal boondoggles and so forth. Larry Summers is one of them. He was a World Bank economist while he was working at Harvard University. He helped redirect USAID funds over to Russia, which helped establish these billionaire Russian oligarchs who have established kind of like a transnational crime syndicate around the Kremlin. He was key into establishing power for Putin in the Kremlin. And there's no kind of mistake or no coincidence that Jeffrey Epstein had a very strong Harvard connection. Because one of the other activities in which Summers was involved in, according to Michael McKibben, who's the head of Leaders Technology, is that he stole the patent. He was involved in stealing a patent that has enabled the technocrats to scale, social media. So without that patent, internet banking wouldn't be possible, nor would, Facebook and email and all of the means that they're using to harvest our data and to kind of weaponize technology against us. I thought it was also interesting that during the pandemic, Larry Summers was advising Gabe Bankman-Fried, the brother of Sam Bankman-Fried, on a new group called Guarding Against Pandemics. And that organization wanted to receive an unlimited number of amount of federal funds to weatherize buildings and residences and so forth. And among them was a permanent lockdown, that we should never,
Date this again, permanent lockdown approximately. Go ahead.
That would be during the Trump administration.
All right.
And it was a group called Guarding Against Pandemics. He was also one of the interim advisors to OpenAI and, the group that I think is behind ChatGPT, led by Sam Altman. So you'll find, these characters, are recurring. And then, of course, China is now providing an existential threat against the United States, allegedly. China has been guided on its AI and technology since the first Bush administration. Bill Gates was connected to the communist Chinese government and has been advising them and developing five-year development plans with the Chinese government and their military. So you'll find the same groups of people working on all sides.
It's almost always the same group of people somehow connected to anything of importance or power or structure that wields influence. That's who they are. That's what they do. That's the river they swim in and float down. It's the river of utter hegemony and control, and you can't give them too much. Go ahead.
No, you're absolutely correct. And if you follow, the developments, follow the steps that they took to acquire the position that they have, you'll find a lot of alleged fraud and misconduct and, alleged illegalities that would provide a basis for the people to challenge what they're doing.
Very good. All right. Thank you. Wonderful overview. Very enlightening and helpful. The book is The Saudi Swindle. Yeah, it was great. And just briefly, it says under the book on Amazon, in this well-researched book, Susan Bradford explores the deception behind the Saudi petrodollar, which gave rise to an urgency to address climate change, BRICS, and a worldwide lockdown, as global planners forged a new strategy to keep global development on track. All is not as it appears. Bradford peels back the layers to reveal the truth surrounding the petrodollar and the U.S.-Saudi relations in all of its complexity. If you don't know your enemy, friends, you're not going to have much of a chance to understand the big picture. So this book is key to that. Thank you, Susan. Great to talk with you again.
Thank you, sir.
You stay well.
You do the same.
Okay,
all right,
thanks.
Thank you.
Right.
Bye-bye.
All right, and we'll beep beep right back in just a few minutes. Hold on.